This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And as you heard on the newscast at the top of the hour, the report late last night after Tiger Woods emerged from surgery was that the surgery was successful to repair his damaged legs from the one car accident in which he was involved. By now, everybody knows.
Yeah, they put a rod in his tibia, and then he put in some screws and plates in his foot and ankle.
And he is recovering. The chief medical officer and interim CEO at Harbor UCLA Medical Center released a statement that the Tiger Woods Twitter account repurposed this late last night. Suffered significant orthopedic injuries to his right lower extremity that were treated during emergency surgery by orthopedic trauma specialists. Comminuted open fractures affecting both the upper and lower portions of the tibia and fibula bones were stabilized by inserting a rod into the tibia. Additional injuries to the bones of the foot and ankle were stabilized with a combination of screws and pins. Trauma to the muscle and soft tissue of the leg required surgical release of the covering of the muscles to relieve. Sort of translating a doc speak there. Both his tibia and fibula snapped and went through the skin. That's what that means. The syndrome in the leg was swollen from the additional trauma throughout. They had to cut it open to release all of the pressure inside. That's sort of translating that. And so, I mean, these are, you know, the reporting, of course, is, yes, it could have been much worse. Obviously, you see the car flipped over and you get the reporting from law enforcement there. It could have been much worse. Thankfully, he's going to be all right.
Well, I'm sorry. But thankfully, he's wearing his seatbelt because if he didn't have a seatbelt on, they don't think he would have made it.
Yeah, but these are very serious injuries. And so the question really, since we've been watching Tiger Woods, at least many of us, since literally he was 2 years old on the Mike Douglas show. I mean, think about that. 40 years of this guy from the age of 2 to 45 being in the public eye, being a celebrity from the age of 2 to present. And what is it you hope for Tiger? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Well, you know, I mean, besides being a masterful golfer, he's come back so many times, winning the Masters in 2019 after, you know, having that incident with his wife and other women in 2010. He's always been a fighter, and President Trump actually called into Fox News to talk about his friend last night.
Well, I was really surprised, and, you know, he's doing so well. He's getting the back in shape, and then a thing like this happens. He's had a big problem, as you know, with his back for a long period of time, and it's amazing. He won the Masters, and he won the Masters with a bad back, which tells you the level of talent is incredible. And he's been working on that, and then he has this happen. It's just tragic.
Yeah, Tiger Woods actually hosting this tournament over the weekend, which is why he was out to L.A. way, and he gave an interview to Jim Nance on Sunday about his future prospects. Talking about that latest back surgery that President Trump mentioned, his fifth, and whether or not he was going to be in game shape for the Masters in April.
Everybody wants to know how you're feeling, what you're doing since you've come off your fifth back operation. You feeling all right?
I'm feeling fine. I'm a little bit stiff. I have one more MRI scheduled so that we'll see if the annulus is scarred over finally, and then I can start doing more activities. But still in the gym, still doing the mundane stuff that you have to do for rehab, you know, the little things, and before I can start gravitating towards something a little bit more.
So as far as golf, what have you done since the surgery? Anything?
I have lengthened my putter.
Okay, right. Starts with that.
Starts with that, you know. I don't have to bend over as far. No, I've gone to the same length as my sand wedge.
So,
because I do a lot of putting drills, you know, blading, hitting the equator with my sandwich, and I figured, well, if I do a lot with that, why just lengthen my putter to the same length? So I did, and it helped.
So Tiger, 7 weeks from today, final round of the Masters. You going to be there?
Gotta hope so. I got to get there first.
Yeah, so obviously he won't be playing in the Masters this year. He's looking at months of, if not longer, in terms of time period for recovery. But you mentioned the 2019 Masters. For me, Tiger is such an interesting figure, not just because he's been in the public eye for so long, but what has occurred in the public eye over the last many decades, from his 10 years of dominating the sport and really becoming a figure that transcended golf the way that Michael Jordan was a figure that transcended basketball. And he's a Shakespearean figure in so many ways, too. Mm-hmm. There's a really good documentary that, ironically, two-part documentary that came out about him on HBO just a few weeks ago that I highly recommend checking out, because it essentially does the entire life story of Tiger Woods from, you know, the womb, or at least the Mike Douglas show, to present. And the complicated relationship with his father, you know, the choices that he has made over the years, in addition to the obvious, the success that he's enjoyed. And my hope for him, I thought the most interesting moment in recent memory, in addition to the incredible comeback win at the Masters in 2019, was that PGA event a few weeks back, the father-son event, or father-daughter event.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So it was, you know, the PGA Tour pro and their son or daughter. And I think actually there were some LPGA Tour pros as well as their son or daughter, too. But whatever. The point is that it was a Tiger and Charlie Woods. And Charlie Woods, his son, is an outstanding player.
Yes, he is.
If Tiger's not going to...
He could beat you, Dan.
He can definitely beat me. Tiger is not going to get Jack Nicklaus's major record, but Charlie Woods may. I don't know. I don't want to put any pressure on the kid. I think he's like, I don't know, 9 or 10 years old, but maybe he's 11 now. But anyway, just remarkable player. My hope for Tiger, because these injuries are substantial.
Yeah, but you can recover from them. I mean, he will.
He's also, these injuries are substantial. He's 45 years old. We're not talking about recovering from them so you can play your locked-in tee time on Sundays at the local Muni track. We're talking about people talking about him coming back and still being able to, you know, win tournaments and so on and so forth. He's so much bigger than that now. To me, 2019 Masters, capstone of his greatest of all time career. I just want him to be back so he can play golf, so he can enjoy golf with Charlie, so you see him out there, and so he can continue to be a global ambassador for the game. Yeah. So that the game is perpetuated among young people for generations to come.
And he's been doing that. I mean, he's made a commitment on the south side at Jackson Park, you know, per President Obama's request. Hey, can you redesign Jackson Park Golf Course, you know, in conjunction with the Obama Presidential Library?
This is the south side's golf course, and we want everyone to be plugged in. We want their voices to be heard, and we want to create something that they're proud of. That's my responsibility as an architect, is to create something that they all want, and something that I think that, you know, we have the talent to do.
Now, that interview was 5 years ago, and they haven't broken ground yet, but eventually they have plans to do that. And he always cared. That's the time when I met Tiger Woods. I met him at Jackson Park. His dad was there lording over us the whole time, but he was very personable. He said, I want to bring golf to the African-American community. That's why I want to change, you know, eventually get people, get young kids involved, and he held a clinic for kids in the neighborhood, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, maybe he should be tasked with redesigning the Obama world altogether, not just the golf course. Joe in Hoffman Estates.
Good morning, crew. Just wondering if there was any report on the toxicology of Tiger Woods during the accident. And I don't necessarily mean, you know, he was drunk driving or anything. I'm saying with pain in your back like that, you are on usually some medications that make you drowsy, like Norco's and stuff like that. Did you hear anything about that?
Thanks for the call, Joe. There's no indication that he was impaired in any way. That was the initial report from law enforcement. But it's a fair point he brings up because, I mean, Tiger Woods did have that very public stop and arrest for driving while impaired in Florida, and it was because he was hopped up on painkillers after a previous back surgery. This is several years back now.
Yeah, but they said there was no scent of alcohol or drugs. There were no drugs at the scene, and he was coherent. He was talking to the officer the entire time until they extricated him through the windshield.
Dave and Cicero.
Hi there. Yeah, my hope for Tiger Woods, I mean, beyond his recovery, which everybody would hope for,
Right.
Is, as you said, you said he transcended golf, and that right there could point to his future, I hope. I mean, he's been friends with both presidents, Obama and Trump, which is very significant considering the divide in America. So Tiger could be a kind of a icon of a spokesman that could appeal to all of us and what he has to say. You know, the things he's had to recover from and live through. But, you know, like, for example, his mistakes, let's face it, and the maturity he's gained. He's always been mature on the golf course. But his example of self-discipline and focus is a lesson to all of us. So I think he has a bright future beyond golf, greater than golf, perhaps. That's my hope for Tiger Woods.
Thanks for the call, Dave. It's interesting because that was the hope that his father had for him, mm-hmm. Earl, who is a tough and complicated figure, his own self. But I don't know that. I mean, but that's why this documentary I mentioned from put out by HBO is so interesting, because I don't know that Tiger ever warmed up to the idea that Earl Woods had for him, not to be the best golfer of all time, so simply, but to be this transitional figure in human history, like for the globe, in the way that Earl Woods envisioned it, at least as it was so described and certainly indicated by him, was almost like a somebody that would heal the world, which is, boy, that is a lot of pressure to put on somebody who just is a golf impresario. I think, as
and a
I
little
said,
kid.
And not to mention a little kid. Yeah, so I don't know that he ever embraced that role. I don't know that he wanted that role. He certainly doesn't deserve the pressure to try to live up to that impossible standard. But, obviously because of his success and because of his notoriety, there are things that that he could do if he wants to do. But I just want people to be comfortable doing what they're doing what they do. It's like, force this on this. You have to be this messianic figure. No, don't, because it's not going to come across as authentic. Because maybe you're ill-equipped to try to fill that role. Because maybe people, human beings that are flawed, shouldn't be trying to be, you know, messiahs on earth. Just as Dave said, you know, convey the lessons learned for kids. Be an example through the relationship with Charlie and Sam, his two children. Yeah, that's why I go back to that documentary. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call, Amy and Dan. I'm going to date myself. I was just a toddler, but my father was a golf fanatic. And for your listeners, in 1949, Ben Hogan was in a major traffic accident.
Yeah, that's right.
And then they made a movie about him in 1951 called Follow the Sun, starring Glenn Ford, where it showed his recovery and the fact that he was able to recover, come back to golf, and win a few more tournaments, and then moving on. I still remember it, 1964. He was like 50 years old, and he was facing Palmer and Nicklaus, and he almost made it to the championship in one of the major tournaments. It was just unbelievable to see this 50-year-old guy challenge Palmer and Nicklaus. I can't remember what the tournament was, but he came back.
Yeah, it's a great parallel. Thanks for the call, Bob. It's very interesting. It's a different time in golf, but I hope Tiger's competitive drive is going to want to be back on the tour, but and certainly at some point when he's recovered, you want him to be physically there to for the crowd to enjoy him, for the fans to see him. But you know, I don't know. I just like the whole lifetime from 2 years old on of putting all of these expectations into this kid, and that now, man, I you know. Maybe it's time to throttle back a little bit, not to use a car metaphor.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I want to get to schools, just a second, but one more comment on Tiger Woods. We were talking about his injuries and his recovery and our collective hopes for him per his recovery before the newscast. Craig in Mount Greenwood, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Well, yeah, thanks for taking the call. You know, I think the potential is really good for Tiger coming back and being, you know, okay with therapy and all stuff, because I know a number of people and myself, I had rotator cuff surgeries where they were complete 100% tear offs and that. And I had a chainsaw stuck through my leg, my calf and muscle and everything. And I had surgeries and all that stuff. And I'm 100%. Everything was healed and I did the therapy and was real good with it. And and I've seen other people. So, yeah, it's amazing how the body heals and everything like that.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for the call, Craig. It's a good thought. Certainly, that's the hope. My point was, I just want to put it in more profound terms for him, I think, than just talking about coming back, getting back on the tour. Can he win another Masters? Can he win a U.S. Open? Can he still catch Jack? I don't even want to contemplate those questions. But returning to K through 12 education and the reopening of schools, we've got another one. We got another school district where at least some of the teachers, emphasis some, because here we do texturing. We don't speak in absolutes, all or this and never that, you know, the language of children. This is in Pleasanton, California. On Zoom class Friday, in advance of a return to in-person learning this week, at least so long as it's supported and pay particular emphasis to this phrase, so long as it's voted up by both parents and students.
Oh, really?
To return to in-class teaching. This is what one and this ABC affiliate out California Way reported. A few other teachers had the same message for students during their Zoom class, trying to lobby the students essentially against mom and dad.
Essentially, I'll have my desk sort of taped off in an area, and I can't really leave that area.
It seemed an odd tangent in the middle of a Friday Zoom class for students at One Pleasanton High School. And just one day after the local school board voted to return to at least some in-person classes.
If you want to go to school for social reasons, recognize that you absolutely will not have that. There is no question that you are not allowed to interact in any fashion. You cannot work with a partner. You cannot speak with anyone in your class if they are any closer than 6 feet away. I cannot give you help in the classroom.
And so...
Wow, brainwashing. There you go.
Right. In response, parents that were interviewed by that ABC affiliate said, well, yeah, so now our kids come home, or our kids get off their Zoom class, really come home, they're at home, and say, well, I don't know if I want to go back, because if I can't socialize, if it's just going to be like this except in person, then why would I want to go back? And then other parents said, well, other teachers have opined on the topic and are excited to come back, and they're not taking the position of the teacher you just heard, where I'm not going to help you. You can't do anything. You just sit there 6 feet away, you know, stoically and receive wisdom through a screen.
But this is happening every day. And I can tell you at CPS, there's a teacher who said, you know why your parents want you to go back to school? Because they want you out of the house. And I'm like, excuse me. No, I want them back because I want them to develop into young men. And part of that is socialization. And even though they have to wear masks, people are socializing. Ask anyone at a Catholic school or a private school. They're having fun. They're smiling. When they're walking home and they're walking with their friends and their masks are off, they look genuinely happy.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. I'm just wondering for people, generally speaking, if the relationship between you and the teachers and the administrators and the school board at your school has changed. I'm wondering if it's changed. It changed for the better, maybe, or changed for the worse. I just wonder how people are receiving the incidents that we report on this show, and of course they're just scratching the surface. These are anecdotes. I'm sure there are many more anecdotes out there. I'm not saying what it is or isn't representative of, other than the attitude you just heard from that teacher being representative of the teachers' unions nationally. I will say that. But in terms of your actual experience, What is the status of your relationship with your kids' teachers, the school administrators, and the school board to the extent you had a relationship before? And you know who I'd particularly like to hear from? Dads.
Yes, dads seem to get lost in this conversation.
Well, purposely
so. But they can make a difference.
Purposely so. Tim Carney, our friend over at the Washington Examiner, wrote an op-ed that he was asked to write in the New York Times about reopening. And he went through all of the studies that we have pored over. He went through advice and counsel from experts at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health that 3 feet should be the default distance for schools, actually not 6 feet. Who's talking about that? Your kid's school is talking about that? No, of course not. But everybody is a man and woman of science. Everybody's keeping up on the latest and greatest research and the recommendations from people actually doing it, right? Oh, no?
Wrong.
The Duke University study, the CDC advisories for months now. He went through it all. And here was the response that he got from a pro-lockdown, pro-closure teacher, Ann Lutz Fernandez. The response to his op-ed and all of the science and data that he presented in support of reopening schools, which has been his position since March, which has been my position since March. The only difference is I don't have six kids and Tim Carney does.
Wow.
So he thinks probably a lot more about schooling than I do as from a policy perspective. He's thinking about it from the perspective of his six kids. But Ann Lutz Fernandez, her reaction to this? Another dad weighs in, wave off, back of the hand. Oh, dads, you don't know anything. Well, remember this dad? Loudoun County, Virginia.
Oh, I love that.
Shut
dad
up the school board.
Yep. You should all be fired from your day jobs because if your employers knew that you were more inefficient than the DMV, you would be replaced in a heartbeat. I literally just finished a conference call because I'm having to multitask to be here to address you guys. You're a bunch of cowards hiding behind our children as an excuse for keeping schools closed. You think you're some sort of martyrs because of the decisions you're making when the statistics do not lie that the vast majority of the population is not at risk from this virus. The garbage workers who pick up my freaking trash risk their lives every day more than anyone in this school system. Figure it out or get off the podium. Because you know what? There are people like me and a line of other people out there who will gladly take your seat and figure it out. It's not a high bar. Raise the freaking bar.
I'm going to give staff an opportunity to make sure that the podium and microphone have been.
Please wipe it down ahead of time, please, because we don't want anything to affect us.
Sir, your time is finished. Can you please leave the boardroom?
It's okay. Don't
worry. Thank you.
I'll be back next time. In the next time. To open the freaking school!
Can I ask the deputy to please make sure the gentleman leaves the boardroom?
I feel his pain, and I would scream like that every day. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Clay and Wheeling, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Glad to have you back, Dan.
Thank you.
My first comment is that I have a friend who teaches first grade in the CTU. She was told directly by her representatives to lie every time she walks into the school to say that she has been in contact with people with COVID, that she has COVID symptoms, even all that stuff. Oh, yeah.
Oh, so that yep. She doesn't have to teach in person?
So that, you know, their statistic numbers go up, et cetera, et cetera. Yep. So don't think that isn't happening for one moment.
Well,
my second point is that my girlfriend is a high school employee. She works for a Catholic high school in the area, and she says that most of the kids that are returning are very happy, social, very, very positive, but there is a handful in her school who are just massively depressed, refusing to come in, failing very, very hard, and she says it's very troubling for her to see, and it strains a lot on her and the staff.
Well, they're probably depressed because they're not in school, and they need to be in school. But some parents won't let their kids in school, Dan.
I want to hear from dads. I want to hear from dads. You're just going to abdicate? Take the back of the hand from, I don't know, from your wife, frankly, or from members of the school board, or from administrators? You're going to be dismissed like that guy in Loudoun County, Virginia, like Tim Carney in the New York Times? Chris and Carrie.
Hey, good morning. So, yes, I'm a dad. My wife's a teacher. And we are both on board with getting back to school. She wants the kids in her classroom. She needs the kids in her classroom. We just had our school board meeting Monday or Tuesday night. I think it was Monday night. And I did not attend. I attended virtually. I watched it over Zoom. But line of parents before and after during the open discussion imploring the board and the superintendent, Brian Coleman, who seems to be hiding behind
the children,
decisions the board makes. They literally, this is no lie, they have assigned a committee that meets in secret. And then the decisions that come from those secret meetings are not discussed. And they spend about 30 seconds on it at the meeting, filling you in on maybe what was discussed. And he just keeps kicking the can. Oh, well, after all the parents get up and speak, we'll maybe address this next board meeting, next month. He just keeps kicking the can.
It's so frustrating.
We had another dad who stood up. He said he's been in the pharmaceutical industry as a salesman for 25 years. He said he is going hospital to hospital, clinic to clinic. These places are at capacity. He said his company's profits are up $500 million since this started. He said he just sees the impact that this is having, the psychological impact. Even so, he didn't even recognize it in his own daughter. He said he's been, he sees it every day, and he didn't even recognize the signs of his own daughter. It's I don't know what we can do. We got to get these guys off the board in our district. These teachers out here in the suburbs, I don't know about the city, they want to be teaching kids. They need to.
I shouldn't say it. Most of the CPS teachers don't, but there are some CPS teachers who want to get back in class.
I have no doubt.
Right.
Dawn in Taylor Ridge.
Hey, good morning. I'm calling because we have my husband and I fought the school board from the beginning to get these kids back in school. We've been back in school since November. The majority of our teachers want our kids in school. And it's gone pretty well, other than, every other week somebody's in quarantine for getting exposure. So now we're fighting the battle with trying to get these kids so that they can play sports. And do the kids go to school or do they stay home? Because if they go to school, they run the risk of exposure.
Yep.
And if they get exposed, they can't play. And so we are really, that is the biggest struggle we're having right now. We're watching our boys who are 16 and 14 want to play in college struggle with, can I go to school? And if I don't go to school, I don't get to be around my friends. Then it's depressing and it sucks to be home. And, it's really,
that's hard. My friend in Minnesota is going through the same thing. Her son is a star basketball player getting recruited, but he was exposed because someone in the weight room had it. So he had to stay home for 2 weeks and miss 2 weeks of games. And every game counts when you're at that level. But they made the decision to have him stay home so that he could play the sports. And I know it makes no sense, and it's
at,
a horrible
right?
predicament to put you in.
Yep, and that's where we're at right now. And we come to Chicago every weekend to play for our son to work with the quarterback trainer. He's being recruited. We're going to South Dakota tomorrow for a junior day. And if he doesn't get all six games in, that's huge for him. So right now we've got football players that are now been exposed in the classroom that have to stay home and are going to miss, not get the 10 practices in. It's a mess. Our kids should not have to be choosing whether they go to school or whether they play a sport. This is absolutely insane.
Thanks for the call, Dawn, and good luck with your son. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Damie. So let me understand this. It's okay to have, quote unquote, children in cages so long as it's only temporary? How else to explain the previous statements by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris during the Trump administration, amplified, of course, by a hysterical D.C. press corps, about juvenile detention facilities at the border, and square that with the announcement that the Biden administration is reopening the juvenile detention facility at the border? This was the back and forth between Jen Psaki and Steve Ducey's kid there, who's actually, Peter is becoming a good reporter. I mean, I shouldn't belittle him by suggesting he's only there for nepotism. Maybe nepotism got him in the door, but he's actually doing quite a good job, so I want to recognize that. He raised this issue because who else in the press corps is going to if not him?
So it's a temporary reopening during COVID-19. Our intention is very much to close it, but we want to ensure that we can follow COVID protocols as unaccompanied minors come into the United States.
So again, her explanation is because COVID, it's okay to put children in cages. Now, I'm not saying children in cages was accurate. It was inaccurate. It was a hysterical, hyperbolic characterization of what was happening at the border. It was the effort by people like AOC, who refer to them as concentration camps, right, to demagogue the president, to demagogue federal law enforcement officials, to demagogue Republicans. And a lot of people bought it. And I'm sure you've heard, Amy, as well, from people who say, you know, I don't know what to make of everything, but that children in cages thing, that just really so bothered me.
And
that was really bad.
Yeah. And a lot of them were memes where they put children in, like, smaller cages. Those were memes. Those were not actual cages. Okay? I mean, yes, they are quarantined in areas, but it's not what they think it is. And President Obama is the one who started that to begin with, not President Trump.
And so after that explanation of, so it's okay temporarily to put people in concentration camps, your description, Ducey's pushback generated the subsequent bailing of water by Psaki.
But it's the same facility that was open for a month in the Trump administration, summer 2019. That is when Joe Biden said, under Trump, there have been horrifying scenes at the border of kids being kept in cages. And Kamala Harris said, basically, babies in cages is a human rights abuse being committed by the United States government. So how is this any different than that?
We very much feel that way. These are facilities. Let me be clear here. One, there's a pandemic going on. I'm sure you're not suggesting that we have children right next to each other in ways that are not COVID safe, are you?
I'm suggesting that Kamala Harris said that this facility, putting people in this facility, was a human rights abuse committed by the United States government. And Joe Biden said, under Trump, there have been horrifying scenes of at the border of kids being kept in cages. Now, it's not under Trump, it's under Biden.
This is not kids being kept in cages. This is a facility that was opened that's going to follow the same standards as other HHS facilities. It is not a replication, certainly not. That is never our intention of replicating the immigration policies of the past administration. But we are in a circumstance where we are not going to expel unaccompanied minors at the border. That would be inhumane.
So we're not doing that. It's not our intention to replicate policies of the previous administration, but we are doing that. Exactly. But we're only doing it temporarily. So what we characterize as inhumane, because that was a policy dealing with a surge of children and migrants at the border, that was inhumane when they did it. But because it's not our intention to do what they were doing, it's humane.
And the media isn't offended by this at all. I mean, even AOC is giving mild criticism to President Joe Biden's decision to open immigration detention facilities for kids. And yes, the number of unaccompanied children is creeping up. But if anybody who has lived on the border knows that the parents send the kids over, they get established, and then later they bring their parents over. That's how that works. Because Jill Biden's mission, you know how each first lady has a mission? Hers is to reunite children with their parents at the border. That's her mission. Well, good luck, because they have another motive than you do. Wake up, you Democrats. I don't understand how this works.
So what was concentration camps under President Trump generates just a plaintive wail from the Jim Acostas of the world. Jim Acosta tweeting in response to this policy development. Can't we be the country that doesn't do this to migrant children?
Oh, God.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty soft compared to can't we be a country that doesn't elect Hitler and set up concentration camps at the border, which was the narrative that was pounded by all these Democrat socialists and their media handmaid. And by the way, to the extent that you want something other than a juvenile detention facility, a one where children are treated humanely, we don't have, you know, ICE agents, Customs and Border Patrol. These are not Nazis. I hate to break it to the left. They weren't Nazis during the Trump administration, and they're not Nazis during the Biden administration. And it's obscene to suggest so. And it's even more obscene to intermittently suggest so, depending on who's in the White House, which is exactly what the Democrat socialists are doing. But there's a larger question here, too, which is you want to close these facilities. OK, well, then what is it exactly you want to do? And what is it exactly they want to do is they want to provide a pathway and a rather expeditious one to some 22 to 30 million people in this country illegally. That's what they want to do.
And by the way,
underwrite their education at using taxpayer dollars. That's what they want to do.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Nathan in Fond du Lac.
I am amazed at the liberal media of what they portray the Republican Party as versus what they themselves do and how they toe this line continually. The upsetting part is the Republican Party doesn't fight back, and maybe it's because they don't have the media, the owned media, that the liberal media has, that the Democrats have. And it is nauseating when you hear point, counterpoint, and I got a segue here really quick. One, I love listening to you guys' station because it's a point of truth that you don't get in many other places. And
thank you.
Hearing what you guys are saying and speaking about, actually trying to get a level of the truth out, but the minimum amount of people that actually get to hear it, how controlled it is, it's ridiculous. And I'm going to let you go, and thanks for listening to me. Bye.
Thank you, Nathan. Appreciate the
thanks
call.
Thanks for calling.
Tony in Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Dan, what amazes me is the fact that you said unaccompanied, and Amy mentioned it. I mean, when are we going to wake up? All the unaccompanied, why are they unaccompanied? Why are they coming here? We saw this with Reagan, too. They want to get amnesty. Then they're going to address it, and they're going to never address it. And Dan, you know that shirt that you were talking about? I'm sorry that I missed it the other day because I would have said it should be Yabba Dabba Doo because people would have had to look up that it's Fred Flintstone and that he was being cloned by the Martians. And they maybe they'd think a little bit, but I doubt it.
All right. Thanks for the call, Tony. Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. I'm a little bit surprised that Jen Psaki didn't appeal to the humanitarian aspect of it, that they keep them in cages only for a short time because human traffickers like free range illegal aliens. So if you cage them too much, they don't grow strong, and free range human traffic is it's just more humane.
I see what you did there. That was good.
Thanks for the call, Ra. We need a little bit of levity in these times, I suppose. There's something else too, by the way, just as a quick aside, per the exchange between Psaki and Ducey. Have you noticed that Jen Psaki isn't very good at her job, or is it just me?
Well, you got to give her at least 2 months. And then if she's still as bad as she is now, then she needs to go.
But I mean, right now you would suggest that she is not compelling.
No,
she doesn't seem to have command of the underlying issue. And she doesn't seem to be very good at lying. And with this administration, if you want to be a successful press secretary,
you've got to lie.
the obsession that the D.C. press corps had with the spin coming from a Spicer or a Huckabee or a McEnany. Oh, my goodness. Oh my goodness, the truth teller test. Are we going to get the truth today? You know, spokes being for the president. Oh boy, you don't have to ask the question with Jen Psaki because you know you're not. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, sticking with President Biden and his administration, but let's focus on President Biden. This wasn't focused upon enough in the campaign, in part because, as I said at the time and during the campaign, President Trump and his campaign made the mistake of focusing too much on Biden's mental acuity and not enough focusing on his complete lack of character, that he is a pathological liar, a fabulist. He is a scoundrel, as Kevin Williamson properly described him in National Review. He lies consistently. And interestingly, the lies sort of fall into categories. Like about how many times he's, you know, run afoul of the law doing something heroic. I mean, he's the classic politician in the sense that, you know, everything he's doing is either a funny story or, right, a tale of heroism.
But you're right, though. The media passes, and people, American citizens, passes lies off as, oh, well, he's just got early stages of dementia. He didn't mean to say that. What he meant to say was this. It's been a whole, you know, four decades of it.
One of his star turns on Letterman show back in 2007, where he talked allegedly about being arrested at the Capitol when he was 21 years old.
So what was that like, walking into the great Senate chamber at 29 years old?
You know, I walked in when I was 21 and I got arrested. It was a Saturday. I was down visiting some friends at Georgetown University. And I came up on a Saturday morning because I was fascinated with the Senate. And they had a Saturday session. I walked up those days, no guards stopping you everywhere. And they just got out of session. I walked in the back. All of a sudden, I found myself in the chamber, and I was stunned. I walked up, sat down, the presiding officer's seat. Guy grabbed me by the shoulder, said, "You're under arrest."
Did that really happen?
There's no record it happened.
Of course.
And then he goes on to say, you know, 8 years later when I got there, he's like, "Do you remember me? You know, you got to complete the story. Do you remember me? I'm the guy who, you know, tapped you on the shoulder and, you know, Joe Biden's telling him it arrested you." And they had a real chuckle over it. So a false claim of arrest. I'm going to assert that it's false. There's no record of it.
No, I mean, maybe the guy told him to leave if he was even there, but there was no, he didn't process him. Take him to the station.
Arrested in South Africa when he traveled to South Africa to stand with Nelson Mandela against apartheid. Remember that? That ran right into the 2020 campaign. He threw his arms around me and said, "I want to say thank you, Mr. Biden," told onlookers at a Las Vegas lunch, Black History Awards lunch in February of last year. "What are you thanking for? What are you thanking me for, Mr. President?" He said, "You tried to see me. You got arrested trying to see me." That was Joe Biden not only telling a lie about himself, but also telling a lie about what Nelson Mandela allegedly told him. He finally dropped it when Andrew Young, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. at the time, who traveled with Biden to South Africa, disputed his account. And then the campaign papered over it with what he meant to say was he got separated from his party at the airport at Joburg. Well, that's not quite the same thing, is it? Oh, and this one, too, which is underreported. Did Joe Biden get arrested in an Ohio University women's dorm in the 60s? Yeah.
What?
He described a visit to Athens, Ohio. This was back when he was running as part of the Obama-Biden ticket when he was the VP
Ohio
candidate.
University.
Yeah, that he made a little mistake when visiting the campus of Ohio U for the, part of being from the University of Delaware, going to a football game there. "I wandered in, I met this lovely group of Ohio University students, and without knowing it, I shouldn't admit this on national television because it'll reveal that I'm over 60, but I thought that we were going to go get something to eat, so I just said to two young two young women I had met said, well, I'll come with you. And they said, okay. And I walked into their dormitory and was immediately accosted by a cop who arrested me because back in those days, men were not allowed in the women's dorms. But I promise you, I never breached the first floor, and it was only a temporary detention, but that's what I most remember about Athens.
What?
Yeah, well, that's not true.
No.
There's no record of that either.
Well, and he also misled Americans about his academic career, including his law school ranking, how many undergraduate degrees he has. I mean, it's just...
Right, the ones that are known, the plagiarizing right. Neil Kinnock, the lying about the driver who tragically killed his first wife and daughter, saying that he was drunk. He had essentially had a liquid lunch. There's never evidence of that. That, in fact, there was some evidence, I mean, it was Joe Biden's first wife's fault that the accident occurred, that she had blown through an intersection. But he continued to suggest that that she was the victim of a drunk driver, or an impaired driver, and that wasn't the case. That is sick. He is a bad person.
Well, he lies,
and I'm a little
so much
tired of allowing this stuff to be papered over. Like, oh, he's just a doddering old man, or, you know, he's a congenial fellow, he's an amiable dunce. No, he's not. He is not a good person based on his conduct over decades that repeats itself again and again. And people should start paying attention and sharing these stories as they continue to pile up, and I'm sure they will during his term as president.
And where's Corn Pop? Never found Corn Pop.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. CDC recommendations for school reopenings does not include a suggested requirement that vaccinations be a prerequisite for in-person instruction. That was something the teachers' unions had been demanding until they stopped demanding it, as in Chicago.
And this is so juicy, and I know you hate the word juicy, but I love this story. Payback's a biatch, if you know what I mean. So the Chicago School Board, Dan, is considering giving the CEO of CPS authority to make COVID vaccines mandatory for employment. Because remember, the CTU spent months fighting for its members to receive a vaccination before returning to school. Well, now they want it to be mandatory. And guess what? Jesse Sharkey's panties are in a bunch.
We believe there's an obligation to bargain with the union over things that are conditions of employment. And we would expect the board to bargain with us about this.
Well, the policy also includes a provision that requires CPS employees to show proof they've received a vaccine.
I suspect that the board is trying to figure out who's been vaccinated so they can force people off of their accommodations back into the school buildings. We have real worries about that.
Oh, it's because they're not controlling the narrative anymore. They lost their power.
No, they didn't.
Well, if they make it mandatory, then what are they going to do? Go on strike again?
You can file a unfair labor practices grievance and litigate it. And then what will happen, if you've been watching Chicago for, I don't know, 50 years,
yes,
what will happen is the mayor will cave and they'll negotiate a deal on it.
Well,
because the union's, the union is in control of that school. Nothing has changed. So I wouldn't be spiking the football about them changing their position. That's what they do. And then guess what? The politicians do the same thing.
But labor law experts say employers can legally mandate proof of vaccination.
That's fascinating. Your experts, your unnamed labor law experts. What he's saying is that per the collective bargaining agreement, these are matters that have to be negotiated. And so who has leverage in that system? The teachers' union or the politicians? Have you paid attention? You're so focused on the school district. Have you paid attention at all? Who's winning the day? Janice Jackson and Lightfoot or the teachers union? I don't know. Gosh, we're here in March and the kids still aren't back to school and you don't have any plan to get high school kids back to school. Who do you think is winning? I mean, come on.
I know, but it was just the irony of it. Like, oh, well, yes, we're giving you what you want and now you don't want that. Okay.
Right. They're hypocrites.
Yeah, they're hypocrites. Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, we have this other situation. California Congressman Katie Porter.
Was she the thruple? No.
No. That congresswoman is gone. Katie Porter's a celebrated single mom.
Okay.
She's got three kids. Try to follow this logic. As she was explaining to CNN why the kids need to go back to school, but they can't.
It's about what's going to happen when they do all go back to school. And that's where Senator Michael Bennett from Colorado and I have authored a letter to the Department of Education pointing out to them that we can't just put kids back in school as if their learning and social and emotional development has not been severely interrupted. And this problem is particularly acute with regard to math and science education. So it's a workforce issue and a workforce development issue as well.
So here's what I understand her position to be. Kids have been damaged by our decision to close the schools and do remote learning, remote instruction, if any instruction whatsoever. They've been damaged developmentally, academically, intellectually, socially, mentally. And disproportionately, they usually had minority children. Right. Yeah, that's true. And so we need to get them back to school, but we can't return them to school until we undo the damage that we did by keeping them out of school. this is where this is at. And to half the country and to big cities like Chicago, New York, California, L.A. and California, San Francisco, Katie Porter makes sense. That's what's remarkable. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Reed Spalding, contributor to the American Spectator, practicing pathologist. And I note for the record, all opinions expressed are his and not those of his employer. That was read to him by his MedMal, or provided to him by his MedMal insurer, I have no doubt. Dr. Spalding, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on. Good to be with you.
Let's start with Katie Porter. There's an admission that damage was done to kids as the result of policies supported by politicians like Katie Porter, but you can't return the kids to school until you undo the damage that was done by keeping them out of school.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up. I saw that she gave that interview to CNN, and so the question comes to mind, well, so what's the solution? I mean, if you're saying, at least she's admitting that the policies damaged kids, right? For the better part of a year, they've all just kind of been acting like, oh, well, virtual learning's fine, and, you know, kids are resilient. And how many times did you read that in articles about how resilient kids are? They are. But a year later, you're starting to see some real fallout. I mean, a lot of kids have fallen behind academically, socially, emotionally. It's been a big problem. And so at least they're admitting that much. But then the question becomes, well, okay, Katie Porter, what are we going to do? I mean, we can't put them back in school because, you know, taking them out hurt them. So what's the solution? We need to
build a time machine, apparently, post whenever they say the coast is clear on COVID. Here's the other thing, though, too. And you get I know you wrote recently about the CDC's guidance for reopening schools. The CDC has performed disastrously during this pandemic, as far as I'm concerned, and it continues to, partly because it has TV doctors like Tony Fauci that are ubiquitous. And Fauci the other day saying again that just because you're vaccinated doesn't mean you can do things like go out to eat indoors or go to a movie theater and so on and so forth. Well, there are light touch states like Florida that would dispute that sans vaccination, but that's secondary. Those sorts of statements give cover for people to say, well, since we don't know if you can spread after being vaccinated, the default position is to stay in lockdown. Now, Tony Fauci may say, that's not what I'm saying, but you know what? That is the implication of what he's saying. And that's what's taken, statements like he makes are taken by the teachers' unions and political hacks, and they're used to continue to keep kids out of school and communities in lockdown.
Yeah, no, you're right. And it is, the good news about that is there is starting to be data now that is coming out that's saying, well, actually, if you're vaccinated, you're not very likely to spread COVID. I mean, that makes sense. That just makes common sense. But there was some hesitance to just, by a lot of medical professionals to just endorse that position, even though that's generally the way it works for vaccines. I mean, you get vaccinated, you're protected, and you can't spread it anymore because you don't really get it, right? Or you don't get it in a level that causes symptoms. But there's been two recent studies, one out of the UK that found among healthcare workers that they vaccinated that like 86-87% could not spread it. Similar study out of Israel that said about 90% of people that were vaccinated could not spread it. And this is also taking into account like asymptomatic infections too, not just the symptomatics. If you're talking about symptomatic infection, the number's much higher. It's higher than 95%. So I think there's a desire from some people in media, you know, these celebrity doctors or whatever you want to call them in media, to really just completely cover their tail, and they want 100%, you know, guarantee that a vaccinated person won't pass. Well, that doesn't exist. I mean, that's not how medicine works. Nothing's 100%. Nothing.
And sorry to interrupt, but I mean the evidence to the journal Pediatrics, this Duke University led study that just this month, finding that within school infections were extremely rare when students and staff started coming back to school, and other detailed contact tracing efforts found the same thing. Kids and staff really don't spread the virus at school.
Well, if anything, the teacher would give it to the student. That's one study that I read that's a cause of action.
Right.
That's a problem more than student. There's not one report of student to teacher transmission.
Yeah, I mean, it is exceedingly rare that schools would be the driver of this pandemic. I mean, that's been widely accepted for months now. I mean, even Fauci admitted as much. You know, it's been 2 or 3 months. You're right. The American Academy of Pediatrics, they have been putting out, you know, guidelines for how to get kids back in schools and promoting that kids do need to be in school. You know, shocker. They've been putting out this stuff since May, almost, you know, it's been 10 months. So the CDC guidelines that you see, a lot of it echoes what schools have already been doing, but, you know, it's good to, I guess, have it in a formal format from the CDC. But it's the things that we expect, you know, the masking and the social distancing and the cleaning measures and all that. So it's becoming increasingly difficult, though, to take the position that it's not safe for kids to go back to school. I mean, but you basically have everybody lined up now saying, well, actually it is. So then it becomes, what are we talking about? Are we talking about science and data? Or are we talking about your politics? That's the issue.
Mm-hmm. And there's the larger issue of fatality, and what we understand about it now as vaccines are being deployed and so forth. And this was this piece over the weekend by Marty Makary from Johns Hopkins, where looking at what we know in terms of what we're starting to come into even clearer focus than has been previously, the combination of vaccinations, which were about 15% of the population, plus those with natural immunity, plus those who've been infected and survived, puts the COVID fatality rate at about 0.15%, which is about the seasonal flu. And the need to rinse and repeat that data the same way that, for example, the teachers' union continue to parrot their propaganda so as to create fear and maintain control of schools. It seems like we need to be as aggressive and, frankly, repetitive with information like that and information like you were describing with respect to school reopenings and the American Academy of Pediatrics and all the studies, because it just is not penetrating certain portions of the populace.
Right, and I don't know that maybe some parts of it never will, but you're right. We do have to really have an honest accounting of all of this situation when it's over, and let's find out when this is over. You know, what was the actual fatality rate? You know, it certainly wasn't this 3 or 4% stuff that they sold us that started all of this, right? I mean, that's clear. But what actually is it? We really will have to have an honest accounting of the data. And you're starting, you know, You're starting to see that. You can look at, you know, the New York Times, they actually have this really nice little tool where it shows you the most up-to-date, you know, case count and death count per state. I mean, it's partly because they're into the fear business, right? So they like to, you know, give you the latest stats or whatever. But it's proving the point. I was just playing around with it, that the different states that had different strategies are coming out at about the same level this spring. You know, if you compare California and Florida, you know, completely different strategies. California, life has been hell for the past year in most places. Florida, for the most part, it's normal for months and months now. And their average, you know, their 7-day average fatality is the same when you adjust for population. It's literally almost identical. I mean, that doesn't that say something? Does that not mean anything to people that are still taking this position that the lockdowns were necessary and the kids can't go to school and all this and that? It's just nonsense. It's not true. It's false.
You're a medical doctor and a practicing pathologist. How do you think your profession has performed throughout?
Well, it's, I think like anything, there's been some good performing docs and there's been some bad performing docs. I think it depends on where you come from. You know, if you're an infectious disease doctor and you're seeing patients in the hospital every day, you see these patients on the ventilator. You see them crash, you see them die, you have to talk to their family. So, you know, you have a different perspective of how cautious people need to be than if you're someone who's like me, that's maybe seeing other negative aspects of locking down, like people not going to their appointments, missing their cancer screenings, having, you know, X, Y, and Z fallout effects from this. I think, you know, it's hard to judge the profession as a whole. I think you could probably judge different specialties differently. I definitely think some of our, some of these celebrity docs that you see on CNN and these news channels all the time, I think that they have been a bit ambiguous in their messaging, and I don't think that's helped anything. I think we should be focusing more on positive developments, and you know, informing people of the good and the bad, right? I mean, there is good news to be had. I mean, the case counts across the country are stabilizing and going down. The average death rate has been cut in half in the time of the past month. So, you know, there's good news to be had.
Right, but our politicians aren't having press conferences celebrating any accomplishments. They only when they want to scare us, they have daily updates. You know, 27 people died, 112 died. It's ridiculous.
Oh yeah, no, it is a fear-driven machine, and it's you know, they've kind of just been feeding off of each other, the politicians and you know, the teachers' unions and some of the public health people. I mean, they've literally all just been passing this fear, I call it fear porn. They've been passing this around for a year, you know, and it's to the detriment of, you know, we needed a more objective accounting of what's happening. And with time, I'm hopeful that people will honestly look at the numbers and learn something from all this, hopefully.
Dr. Reed Spalding, contributor to the American Spectator and practicing pathologist. Again, all opinions expressed were his own and not those of his employer. Dr. Spalding, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. You guys have a good day.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And normally I'm not one to agree with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, but maybe after yesterday's Senate hearing into the January 6th rioting and violence at the Capitol, I am prepared to agree with Nancy Pelosi for a 9/11 style commission to investigate what occurred in the lead up to and on the day of January 6th. Not for the reason she thinks, but very much as is the case when evidence is the requirement, because I think it will undo the story that the left is telling about January 6th. And yesterday was a bit confusing to me because you had the local police saying that it was a coordinated attack, and politicians saying it was coordinated. And we've talked about that previously based on what we knew when we knew it, which is the idea of like people setting pipe bombs, people coming with, you know, particular weapons.
Right.
And ammo. Some of the suggestion that, yes, there were definitely is some people there that planned to be disruptive and violent. But then that calls into question, okay, well then if there was FBI telegraphing you that this might occur, what was your response? And after saying it was coordinated, at least the acting Metro Police Chief said the district did not have intelligence pointing right to a coordinated assault on the Capitol. But the Washington Post has previously reported about an FBI memo that suggests they did have intelligence. Well, and so that wasn't shared. And then we have the House Sergeant at Arms suggesting that he didn't have a conversation with Capitol Police Chief, the former Capitol Police Chief, that the former Capitol Police Chief says they did have.
Well, Steve Sun, the former Capitol Police Chief that you're talking about, said that he never got that FBI memo from the night before. So it was a bit of a hot mess, because then you had the Sergeant at Arms saying, well, I didn't know it because he didn't know it. And it was just very confusing.
Well, and then you have the additional wrinkle of former Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows saying there was an offer made, because President Trump greenlighted it, from DOD to local authorities to provide National Guard support in advance of January 6th, and that was declined. So, yeah, maybe there is some fleshing out to do. Oh, by the way, it's interesting to listen to politicians like Amy Klobuchar, who voted to convict the president for inciting a riot, say that it was a coordinated attack. Well, if it was a coordinated attack, and if these, and as these law enforcement officials described, it started 20 minutes before President Trump's speech concluded at the Ellipse, then how did he incite something that was coordinated? I mean, if you want to charge him as a conspirator, suggest he was a conspirator, he was behind this, he organized it. Okay, you go ahead and make that assertion, and then you provide evidence to support that, but you can't have it both ways. You can't make a charge for which you have no evidence and suggest it was something else for which you have no evidence. Actually, you can't make a charge that runs counter to the evidence and then say, well, but this is what really happened, and I have no evidence to support that, which is what Amy Klobuchar did, for example. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Roger Kimball, editor of New Criterion. Roger, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yes, my pleasure. If they didn't have double standards, they wouldn't have any standards at all.
Precisely, but we bring you on because you know we're just rubes out in the Midwest. We don't understand the wily ways of Washington D.C., and so we want you to clarify what we just described so you can make it make sense.
Yes. Well. It really is. We've come to the point now where, I think the goodwill and the idea that these people are, just trying to do their best, nobody believes that anymore. They understand that this is a purely partisan, manufactured tort that has no basis in reality at all. The president incited nothing. He suggested that the crowd go patriotically and peacefully to the Capitol. Now, I do believe that he ought to have understood that a crowd can turn into a mob on the turn of the dime. So that's, he bears some responsibility for what happened. But what did happen? You know, the premise of the whole impeachment thing was that somehow five people were murdered by pro-Trump activists. Well, that's not what happened at all. That's not what the one shot that I think was fired by an unnamed police officer and killed a pro-Trump activist, that young lady. That was a tragedy. Why he shot her, it's a little unclear. One person was outside the Capitol and had a heart attack, another pro-Trump person. Another person died of a stroke. One lady seems to have I'm not sure whether she was suffocated or what, but she was part of a throng and she died. And then Brian Sicknick, who was another pro-Trump person, by the way, he was supposed to have been bludgeoned to death with a fire extinguisher, but he wasn't. That was a totally made-up tort by the New York Times
circulated again and again and again, picked up by the Washington Post, picked up by National Review, supposed to be the face of impeachment. It turns out to be completely made up. He didn't. He left. He texted his family that he was fine, and he died. We don't know quite yet how he died, but there's no fire extinguishers were involved.
Well, the medical examiner said there was no blunt trauma to the head.
Yes,
and the family was told that he had a blood clot and a stroke.
Yeah, so there you are. It's but this was the centerpiece of the Democrats' latest impeachment effort, right? This was that Brian Sicknick was lay in state because he was bludgeoned to death by pro-Trump marauders. Completely made up. Now, they shouldn't have done this in the Capitol, but they shouldn't have burned down Portland, Oregon. They shouldn't have burned down Kenosha. They shouldn't have burned down Minneapolis. They shouldn't have rioted in Washington, D.C. and burned, a church and so on earlier in the summer. Where was the outrage then when you had, billions of dollars of damage, almost 20 people killed? Many people injured. This is a totally manufactured outrage for the sake of getting Trump and his supporters. And now you have the capital of the United States surrounded by a wall and razor wire as if we're in some third world hellhole. And it's a very disturbing thing that's going on in this country.
And when are they going to take that wall down? I mean, is there any
that's
the people's house and they should be having tours there.
Yes, yeah, the people's house, that's what Nancy Pelosi says, the citadel of democracy. Well, it looks more and more like the wall between East and West Berlin. I wouldn't be at all surprised if it became a permanent fixture, at least until the next Republican president is inaugurated.
Well, that's another example of their commitment and belief that walls work. Walls keep people safe.
Yeah,
Well, and so we're talking about, her demagoguery on the topic, call for a 9/11 style commission because she thinks this is going to be revelatory to her benefit. And I know you wrote in Am Greatness, I think, or maybe it was The Spectator, that you support the idea of a commission because you think it'll boomerang on her. So do I. But here's the thing. Are we in a place in America, just sort of using this as an example, where to borrow from Churchill, sometimes men stumble upon the truth and most quickly pick themselves up and move beyond it like it never happened.
Move on. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that sort of seems where we're at. And it seems like that's what the Dem socialists count on, and Republicans don't have the stick-to-itiveness they do.
Yes, it pains me to say, but I think that the left is far more persistent, far more organized, and far more wily than conservatives. Conservatives want to be left alone, and they want to leave you alone. The Democrats want to run your life. So I think Lenin said that what is communism? It means keeping track of everything, and that's what the left wants to do. Now they've, under the cover of COVID, they've discovered that the American people are sheep. They'll do whatever you tell them to do. Wear a mask. Stay home. Quiver under your bed. Close your business. Okay, fine, terrific. We're happy to do that. 2 weeks to slow the spread. Remember that? That was a year ago. I'm in Charleston, South Carolina at the moment. It's very sunny here, but people are walking around everywhere with masks. It's insane. Insane.
Well, speaking of that and what is becoming revelatory, what you learn with some distance and some fact checking about things like all that transpired at the Capitol on January 6th, you also learn so much about so many of the actors that played such an instrumental role in opposing Trump and deposing Trump, I would argue. And one of those is Bill Kristol, formerly of the Weekly Standard, who's now over at the Bulwark. And this is just a fascinating piece he wrote for the Bulwark. What about Joe? Why can't anti-Trump become work with Biden? So those never-Trumpers who are trying to salvage the Republican Party and the good name of conservatism are now penning thought pieces about how never-Trump can morph into work with Biden to advance socialism.
Yeah.
I'm afraid so. I know Bill a little bit and like him, but I don't understand what's happened to him. I thought he was a conservative, but I guess I was wrong about that. By the way, what does conservative mean? It means that you want to conserve what's best and most vital in your tradition. What's the opposite? Well, a socialist is somebody who is opposed to private property, wants to, you know, is big on centralizing the government. The more government, the better. So I'm frankly shocked that he should take this position. Joe Biden is on the threshold of senility, and I'm not sure which side of the threshold. He's a puppet, and it to me is just mind-boggling that he would write such a piece. But I think the calculation is that the Democrats are going to be in power for a while, and he wants to be on the side where the gravy flows from.
Yeah, that's a real principled stand. Roger Kimball.
It's kind of like Groucho Marx. These are my principles. If you don't like them, I have others.
Indeed. Roger Kimball, editor of New Criterion. Roger, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Are you ever curious as to why it always seems like America is lurching left, and it's just a question of the pace? Government is always growing. It's just a question of the pace. Your individual liberties are always shrinking. It's just a question of the pace. Why is that happening, regardless of who's in power? The pace, you know, differing just a little bit depending on who's in power. Perhaps with the exception of Trump, were he able to do all that he wanted to do, and some of it, I don't agree. But at least he understood what was happening. Now, not on the spend side. He was just as bad as all these Vichy Republicans. Was not concerned with entitlement reform. Was not concerned with reining in runaway government spending. Was Keynesian when it came to all this printing of funny money. Wrong. Maybe a second term would have been different. Unfortunately, we won't ever know. But I do know this. I know the answer to the question I pose about why we're always lurching left is contained in the embodiment of politicians like Mitt Romney. Writing in the Wall Street Journal, in opposition to Joe Biden's $2 trillion package of funny money, of which more than a third has nothing, will not be spent in the immediacy, has nothing to do with pandemic response, even by the generous estimates of the Congressional Budget Office, a third. Mitt Romney trying to offer the sensible compromise position. Don't be a communist, be a socialist, is the Mitt Romney position. Senate Republicans will support whatever is needed to expand COVID testing, accelerate vaccine delivery, support health providers, and will likewise support robust assistance for those who've been crushed financially by the pandemic, including by losing their jobs. We propose a $618 billion compromise measure that matched President Biden's proposed health and vaccine funding, extended federal unemployment benefits, provided economic relief for those with the greatest need, included nutrition funding, small business assistance, resources to get children safely back to school, and we stand ready to negotiate a plan that helps America recover from this dread disease, and so on and so forth. In other words, we start from most of your premises, and we want to print money too. We just want to take a more leisurely gait down the path to serfdom, or more specifically, the road, if I'm going to be Hayekian here. And he's got some erstwhile conservatives on board with him, in pertinent part. Consistent with that philosophy, to the extent it's discernible, unless, if you call surrender a philosophy, I suppose. Mitt Romney and Tom Cotton from Arkansas, proposing, I'll see your $15 minimum wage mandate, federal, and walk you back to, how about a $10 minimum wage, federal? How about we phase that in a little bit more slowly? we look at $10, and we look at going from $7.25 an hour to $10 an hour by 2025, and then index that to inflation every 2 years for bumps. Because we don't disagree with the premise that the federal government can set wages by fiat. We just want to slow walk to the place you're at today. Isn't that inspired? Is that good public policy? Is there any principle at stake in this discussion? There doesn't seem to be. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author, noted economist. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. I'm glad to hear that you guys are still on the air. You know, the Democrats are trying to race any conservative radio or TV, so that I guess your days are probably numbered.
We're willing to compromise and have ourselves replaced by...
So you've got us on 3 days a week.
No, we have to be replaced. Yes. We have to be replaced by a Mitt Romney-style Republican. So for the easy listening compromise
exactly.
rhetoric.
Because you guys are insurrectionists, you know. I mean, we can't allow your right. ideas to be... And they are subversive to our culture. And but look, you know, Mitt Romney's bill is... We don't need another penny, folks. I mean, that's the problem. You know, I listened on that list of things that Mitt Romney some of these other senators Republicans want to spend money on. And it's like, we've already done that. That's the thing, folks. We've already spent $3.7 trillion on those things. We've already done the vaccine distribution funding. We've already provided nutrition assistance and rental subsidies and aid to states and cities. We've already spent $50 billion for the schools. You know, this is just on top of all of that. It's like the cherry on top of the sundae. It's a $1.9 trillion cherry. And you're right, Mitt saying what? No, not $1.9 trillion, $600 billion cherry. We don't need more money. We got to get the vaccine out there. I love what the Wall Street Journal said the other day. I think it was Friday. That by mid to late April, anybody who wants the vaccine will pretty much have access to it. That is the stimulus. But you're right. This idea that somehow we're gonna make everything whole by spending $1.9 trillion. It's amazing to me how generous politicians are with other people's money. I mean, there's just no end to how generous they are.
You know, you talked about the schools.
Big-hearted people.
Yeah, K through 12 schools, $129 billion. The last time, $13.2 billion after that, $54.3 billion. I mean, the numbers are outrageous. And the schools aren't even open. What about giving teachers hazard pay to try to get them to go back?
No.
Well.
What about not?
Look, I mean, you guys saw, we talked about, chatted a little bit about this last week. I mean, about what happened in Naperville, where I love that story. Why is every single school district in Illinois giving money back to the property owners and their property taxes because you didn't provide the education services you promised? We paid for the services. You didn't provide them. You provided half services. So give us half of our money back. I mean, why are we giving more money to the schools? The school district should be giving more money back to us.
I know. What did they give them? $10 million back to property owners in Naperville?
Yeah, about four. The average person in Naperville is going to give a $400-$500 check. Now, that's not a huge amount of money, but
it
helps.
Money.
And you know they. Yeah, people have been suffering. We act as if the people have been suffering are the government. It's not the government. The government has plenty of money. It's us.
Okay, Steve, get back to my underlying question here, because you know these Republican Neros are a real problem, and Cotton signing on to a slower phase in of a minimum wage increase is ridiculous, and he's doing it under the guise of, well, we're going to go after employers who will hire illegal immigrants, so we'll provide more jobs for Americans at a better rate. That's a bunch of nonsense. And we have too many people indulging these nonsensical Nero Republicans, and it will lead to two things. One, Democrat majorities for a long time, and two, the end of America as we know it. Not to be hysterical here, but I mean, that's the reality.
Well, this is a pretty dangerous moment, folks. I mean, you're not exaggerating. I mean, these numbers are so large that we can't even comprehend them, but you know, when I first came to Washington, we talked in the millions and billions. Now we're talking about in the billions of trillions of dollars. We're talking about taking our national debt to $30 trillion. We're talking about borrowing in 1 year more money adjusted for inflation than we borrowed to finance the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War. I mean, come on, these numbers are just – so outrageous. Do you remember, you know, when you were talking, Dan, it reminded me of, you know, after the 8 years of Reagan, and, you know, Reagan rebuilt the American economy, won the Cold War, you know, just this amazing accomplishment, and really relying on freedom and the private sector and free enterprise to do it. And George H.W. Bush, you know, ran as his successor. And remember, he said, we're going to have a kinder and gentler nation. Remember mm-hmm. that? And I remember Reagan said, kinder and gentler than who? Come on. What's kinder and gentler than rebuilding the economy? You know, and why are you going to be kinder and gentler with other people's money? So, you know, there's no generosity in the if these politicians were so generous, why don't they put up some of their own money? I mean, Mitt Romney's rich.
Well, be wary of politicians who speak of their compassion through government, their kindness
exactly.
and their genteelness through government. Those historically have been the greatest thugs to ever be visited upon the countries over which they lorded. That's sort of what I'm talking about. And it comes in all sorts of forms, including the identitarian form. And just going back to some of the hidden gems in this $1.9 trillion, the Biden plan would pay 120% of any government or government-backed loan for farmers or ranchers considered socially disadvantaged, which the bill defines as Black, Asian American, Hispanic, or Native farmers. In other words, they're going to pay off the farmers' debt and give them an additional 20% bump on top of that.
Hold on, Jeff. Are you saying that if you're white, you don't get the money, but if you're Black or Hispanic or Indian or Asian or what? I mean,
well, that's what
what's happening to our country.
No, I mean, wait a second. Wait, but just to just so we get the details here. 20% bump on being in addition to having the debt paid off. And it's the argument is this is for farmers who were overlooked in other programs, including subsidies given by the Trump administration
with
respect to tariff policies. You have to prove that. You don't just get to, I'm sorry, were Black or Asian American farmers not provided subsidies through the Trump administration? I don't remember any such legislation.
But also, I mean, have you looked at what's happened to the commodity prices? Price of corn and wheat and soybeans, they've been rising. The farmers are doing just fine. I mean, look, they've had a tough year. Everybody's had a tough year. I mean, are we going to bail out everybody? We have to bail out the Dan and Amy show. I mean, you know, fewer people are driving. So
there's a GoFundMe page for that.
Yeah, and I want an identitarian. I want an identitarian 20% kicker on it, too.
Well, you know what? I'm in favor of GoFundMe. I mean, why don't we just have, instead of $1.9 trillion, it's a great idea, Amy. Why don't we just have GoFundMe for the farmers, for the small businesses, for this and that? I mean, there are those out there, and American people are charitable. They can provide money to people in a better way than these government things can. You know, my favorite story of all time, if I may just spend 30 seconds, there's a great, great story. People should look it up on the Internet. It's about Davy Crockett. Davy Crockett was a, you know this one, Dan? He was a member of Congress, one of the great American patriots of all time. He was the Alamo. And there was a relief bill to provide, you know, $50 million for, you know, fire victims and orphans. And he said, look, this is not, the title of the piece is not ours to give. And he said, we don't have the right in Congress to write checks to, you know, on the taxpayer dime for these people. He said, why don't we each, every one of us, every member of Congress, why don't we each write a check ourselves to help the widows and orphans? And of course, at the end of the story, what we find out is that Davy Crockett was probably the poorest member of the United States Congress, but he was the only one who wrote a check to the widows and orphans.
Yeah. No, that is a great story. Well, so
politics hasn't changed a lot.
No, it's good. Yes, well, right. So just quickly going from central planning with respect to fiscal policy to central planning with respect to monetary policy. I mean, the latter is no better than the former, but that's what Jay Powell telegraphed yesterday, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a great point. You know, so Powell is basically saying pedal to the metal. We've printed $6 trillion. We've bought $6 trillion of assets, so the Fed balance sheet is growing. We're seeing. If you don't think there's inflation, he said, I don't see any inflation. Do you see any inflation out there? Has he bought a gallon of gasoline? Has he gotten a fill up? I mean, you know, just in the last since the election day, gas prices. I just looked up this number this morning. Gas prices are up about 40 to 45 cents a gallon just since election day. That to me is inflation.
Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, economist, and Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks as always.
Okay, don't let the congressman take you guys off the air. Okay, they want to. They're coming after you. They come after Fox and Newsmax, they're coming after you guys.
Thanks. Have a good day.
Bye.
And bye, Darren. He's Stephen Moore. Joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The other week, we spoke with our friend and brilliant legal mind, Richard Epstein, University of Chicago Law, NYU Law, about the litigation that is pending against the Obama Presidential Center in Chicago, not based on the idea that the former president can't have a library center, amusement park, golf course, whatever, if he so wants one, but that you have to comply with state and federal law when it comes to particularly public land. That's the issue. And so Richard Epstein, professor and Protect Our Parks and others who oppose the Jackson Park location, are quick to point out we oppose that location. We don't oppose the idea of an Obama Center. And there are alternative sites that make more sense. So we talked about the legal issues with Professor Epstein. And now we talk about the alternate site and what that would look like and the comparative impact with the architect for this group and for the alternate site that has been proposed. He is Graham Balcony. He's an architect and preservationist, and he joins us now. Graham, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thank you so much for having me on board to talk about this really, I think, critical issue facing us as a region in Chicago.
Why is it so critical from your perspective as both an architect and, as you say, a preservationist?
Right. I'm also a 20-year resident of this area, so I can speak from personal experience, having lived both at the base of Jackson Park as well as at the side of Washington Park. So I know this area very well. It's dear to my heart. We're talking about an issue here that extends beyond Obama because there are regional planning implications here. There are community benefit implications here. And really what's at stake is not only the success of the Obama Center itself, but also, of course, our historic parks, our historic boulevard system, and the benefit that those improvements may or may not make to the surrounding communities.
So where would you like to see the Presidential Library be built?
Well, the first priority of Protect Our Parks, who engaged me to participate in this effort, their priority is to say, as Dan mentioned, really, anywhere but a public park. The south side of Chicago is literally teeming with locations. We've done studies. I conducted a study that's roughly 2 miles square in the vicinity of Washington Park to the west of the park, which is where we're presenting an option. And that community has over 270 acres of vacant land. This is a square footage basis, so truly just land area. That accounts for over 40% of the space in that community. So that's where we're presenting an option, which is directly to the west of Washington Park. But truly, the Obama Center could go in many places. Now, I'm sure we'll get into why that particular location west of Washington Park makes the most sense. In fact, it was one of the three options that the University of Chicago presented to the Obama Foundation and to the Obamas as they were making their selection. So we're not the only ones suggesting that this is the best place for it. Unfortunately, that decision was made to locate elsewhere.
Well, speak to this other piece of it, because we've talked a lot about, and Protect Our Parks, of course, has talked a lot about preservation and some of the issues you raised generally. But you said something else about the success of the center itself. That's interesting. Give perspective on why you think the Washington Park site would be more successful for the center itself.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, on their face, they're similar. They're both located relatively equidistant from the main quad of the University of Chicago. They're both, of course, in the greater Bronzeville area, if you will, although the Washington Park site is much closer to the historical core of that community. But really, the key thing here is the Washington Park site is directly plugged into the infrastructure of our city. So you have a Green Line station right there. If you were to take the Green Line to that site today, you would see parking lots and empty lots, storefronts with nothing in them. I mean, it's really striking that we have mass transit that leads us basically nowhere. And that hurts the community. You know, that this is a potential where we could bring people to the site and really engage them in the community for the benefit of the community. So how does that hurt the Obama Center? Well, their goals are to reach out and touch that community. Their goals are to make a difference in Chicago. The site in in Jackson Park that they've chosen is, you know, again, on paper, it might look like it's proximal to a number of things, but it's very segregated. It's very sequestered. The Illinois Central Railroad track, which was incidentally the first elevated railroad in Chicago, is on a berm right there. It really forms a barrier between Woodlawn, which is the community that they claim to be reaching out to most closely, and the center itself. In between that berm of the track and the park, you have Hyde Park High School, a number of townhouses, low-intensity uses. It's very un-Chicago in a lot of ways. It's very unurban in a lot of ways. And, you know, you contrast that back to the Washington Park location where you have the Dan Ryan, you have the Red Line, you have the Rock Island Line with a potential new station there, and then you've got the Green Line right at your doorstep. So that's the way that we think it most strikingly that this site can really engage the community, because the community comes to that site already.
Well, so would you say that that then the Jackson Park site was selected over this alternate site that you're describing because the Jackson Park site presents more status?
You know, I don't have insight into how they made their site selection, but it would not surprise me if that had something to do with it or the perception of status. You know, one of the great things about the history of Chicago, our legacy of architecture, is we created this city, you know, really out of nothing in some ways. I don't want to sound like I'm disparaging the people who were here before us or to say that the landscape was not beautiful. But, you know, unlike some places which might seem ready for a city, this place was really brought about by architecture to make a community. So I think the Washington Park site, you know, with some vision and with hopefully the plans that we're going to be rolling out shortly, people will start to say, wait, you know, this is equally prestigious. But what I will say is the University of Chicago presented three sites as they were bidding, if you will, for this project. All of those sites included public parkland as an option. And that was really a false trichotomy, in my opinion. The three sites were South Shore, Jackson Park, and Washington Park. And the implication at the Washington Park site was that this beautiful Washington Park Arboretum, which contained some of the oldest living trees on the south side, was mm-hmm. the place to put this building. So if it were me and I were looking at those potentials, I probably would have not chosen that one either. But the reality is we've assembled might not be quite the right word, but we've identified over 14 contiguous acres right there at the Green Line station. Almost all of that is owned either by the University of Chicago or the city. So that's the site. We're actually growing the park. We're actually taking Washington Park and bringing it back to a state much closer to what Frederick Law Olmsted, the landscape architect, had envisioned. And in the process, we're making a place for the Obama Center and for the Obamas that is equally grand, equally prestigious to anything you could possibly do in Jackson Park, because we have more play. We have more flexibility. We're not hamstrung by the preservation concerns. We're not hamstrung by the tight little site along Stony Island, which is frankly not a very beautiful street. So that's the beauty of architecture. That's the beauty of design. We can take this site, which is really an eyesore now and really not productive, not benefiting the community, and turn it into something spectacular. And that story, I mean, that's the story I think the Obamas want to tell us. I do not think the Obama legacy wants to be embroiled in this concept of, well, wait, there was a beautiful park here before we showed up.
Well, do you think that the Obamas are tied to Jackson Park because they have this agreement with Tiger Woods, who, you know, recently made the news because of the car accident? But he was going to be the architect of a brand new golf course there in Jackson Park so that you can go golfing and then go to the Obama Library.
Well, it was his big plan. There's a lot to be said about that. Yeah, and those plans are equally troublesome to me because the South Shore Nature Sanctuary is an incredible place. I would encourage all of your listeners to go there if they haven't been there. So I don't know, but what I could say is we know the president likes to golf. There are golf courses. I'm not sure what's kind of become of these Tiger Woods plans, but what I will say is Frederick Law Olmsted designed the Midway Plaisance. He designed Jackson Park, and he designed Washington Park, and those are actually one of a piece. So to leave or to come to Washington Park along that procession from the lakefront, Jackson Park, down the Midway, that is one of the most beautiful drives in the Midwest, maybe in the country. And I'm sure the president would very greatly enjoy taking that same route to go to the golf course.
And give us a sense, too, just a little bit more of the comparison contrast to make out the case of you've given sort of the 30,000-foot vision, but just in terms of the real-world impact when it comes to land utilization and the spillover effects, positive or negative, between the two sites.
Right. The University of Chicago, as a part of this bidding process, put together some very intensive studies, economic impact studies, traffic studies, and the like, which are available online. It's hard to summarize those succinctly. I mean, they're several hundred pages each. But the overwhelming conclusion is that the Washington Park site is easier and it has more community benefit. So whether you look at that in terms of ease of implementation, whether you look at that in terms of possible negative impact to the community, whether you look at that in terms of transit ridership versus car ridership, the Washington Park site comes out on top of all of those. Perversely, part of the reason for that is because that neighborhood has been so hard hit over time. The Great Cities Institute at the University of Illinois at Chicago conducted a really staggering, very important study just a couple years back where they were looking at census trends in Chicago's black communities. And Washington Park, which is, of course, the neighborhood where that borders Washington Park, the place proper, that community experienced the highest decline of black residents from 1980 to 2017. 65.9% of residents left that community. So that's a terrible thing, and I think the listeners really, I hope everyone is hearing this, because the south and west sides of Chicago are suffering. Mm-hmm. We've lost 32.9% citywide of black residents since 1980. That's almost 400,000 people. And, we cannot afford business as usual. We cannot afford to mess up this opportunity with the Obama Center, which is truly a gift. It's a once-in-a-generation opportunity. So, that's why we're doing this, because, it's too important. This is my neighborhood. And it's hard to see what's happened.
Well, maybe if you can get Mike Kaiser on board to design the golf course. I mean, you look at the job he did with Sand Valley, Abandoned Dunes, maybe that would seal the deal there. You got to be able to counterpoint that golf course feature. I don't know. But I do appreciate your perspective. He is Graham Balcony. He's an architect and preservationist, and he is the gentleman that was retained by Protect Our Parks, part of the team with Professor Richard Epstein as well. That is pushing for that Washington Park location he was describing, as opposed to the Jackson Park location that has been selected by the Obamas for the Obama Presidential Center. Graham Balcony, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Excellent work. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And Amy, this issue you have with veterinarians, I'm unclear what the problem is.
Well, I took Bunky in because Bunky's had a rash on her back, and I took her in December, and they wouldn't let me go in to meet with the vet because of COVID. But, I'm like, I'm fine. I'll play your little reindeer games. And then, but the rash got worse, and I dropped him off yesterday, and I demanded to see the vet, and she absolutely said it's too dangerous. So she talked to me on the other side of a door. And I said, wait, I hope to God I never see you at a restaurant or at a grocery store, or I hope you don't go to any family gatherings, because this is ridiculous. Imagine if you had a child, a baby, and you dropped it off at the pediatrician. No one would do that because the baby doesn't have a voice. You have to tell the doctor what's wrong with the child. Well, you have to tell the doctor what's wrong with the dog. And they've been getting away with this for almost a year now. And I asked the manager, because she came in, of course, and said, ma'am, you're going to have to calm down. But she said, well, we're going to, I go, how long are you going to continue with this? And she said, well, until COVID's gone. I said, COVID's never going away. Cancer's never going away. The flu's never going away. A cold's never going away. So you should, they should all become, work for solar panels. And she said, excuse me? I go, you should fire them all and find people who want to work and actually talk to your customers. Because we're paying for a product here. So I'm, guess what? I'm never allowed back in that vet again. It's done.
I'm so glad I asked. Here's an alternative idea that could have avoided all of that. Just get a new veterinarian.
Right. And that's what I did. I found a new vet and I'm going to go to them next week with Bunky so that I can actually be served as a customer and tell them what's wrong with my dog. So
the stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Disaster in Texas. It's not limited to Texas, perhaps. Good op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by its editorial board. The ice-cold reality is that grid regulators across the United States are struggling to keep power on during extreme weather. They've been able to avoid more blackouts by earning energy conservation, but Texas shows that conservation isn't enough. Progressives want to make Americans even more dependent on the grid by banning gas hookups in homes, mandating electric cars. This is a recipe for blackouts nationwide. As coal and nuclear plants retire because they can't compete against subsidized renewables. In fact, they cite New England's grid operator in 2018 predicted outages in the winter of 2024-2025 in most cases it analyzes. The nature of the composition of energy sources is altered by the subsidies in one direction to the exclusion of others, at least at the respective levels. And they are quick to remind us, yes, that various aspects of the grid failed, but it was wind energy in Texas that performed the worst over the last 2 weeks when you had those shutdowns, the power outages. For more on all of this, we spoke about him a little bit earlier in the week when we were talking about the grid and talking about what happened in Texas, because he gave an extended interview to the Epoch Times, which was illuminating, and want to continue to do the postmortem on Texas as well as talk more generally speaking about energy policy. He is Jason Isaac, he's with the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and he joins us now. Jason, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
That's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
So just give us quickly your understanding of what happened in Texas with respect to the failures that negatively impacted, were such a disaster for so many people.
Yeah, well, and you talked about the foundation talking about market distorting policies of subsidies, the advantages that wind and solar unreliable sources of generation have over our thermal generation, which is clean coal, nuclear, and natural gas. I wrote about this last summer, warning that had it not been for the COVID pandemic, that this would have happened in August, and it actually almost happened in August, even with the shutdown. And it's because our reserve margins are so low. 10 years ago, we had 20% extra electricity available to meet peak demand, and now we have nothing. And it got down to 2% this past summer, and that's going to continue to be the case because you can't compete in a market that is so distorted when wind and solar get incredible advantages that thermal producers don't get. And the market has responded accordingly. And we've seen a net decrease of thermal generation being built and a massive, almost 200% increase of unreliable generation in wind and solar being built.
Well, Jason,
you couple that with some bad decisions that were made with the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, not recognizing that this was happening when it was happening on late Valentine's night, early President's Day morning, and power plants tripped and we lost more generation because of bad decisions made by people at the helm of ERCOT.
Well, what percentage of alternative energy is used in Texas?
They were touting last 2019, the last year numbers are fully available. 23% of our electricity was generated from wind and solar when they have about 33% of the installed capacity. So they're not living up to their installed capacity. And then you look at what happens on February 15th, that number goes to 8% of installed capacity. Half the windmills were frozen. Those that were producing electricity weren't producing very much. And our grid manager, ERCOT, wasn't expecting them to produce much. Unfortunately, at some points in time, they dipped down to below 1.5% of installed capacity. And that is just horrible. You wouldn't hire an employee that's only going to work 20% of the time, much less 1.5% of the time. But we've heavily subsidized that here in Texas and at the federal government.
There was an op-ed from a energy broker named James Cargas in Washington Monthly about this, and he provided a little historical context. He reminded readers of this storm in February of 2011, another polar vortex, freezing temperature descended upon much of Texas. Gas generators saw their equipment freeze, become unavailable. Then wind generation was a minor portion of ERCOT's capacity. The impact was blackouts impacting 3.2 million consumers that lasted hours, not days. And ERCOT called on generators, gas producers, wind turbines to weatherize their equipment. Not everyone complied. He describes this as this crisis over the last several weeks as not one of lack of transmission lines or energy generation, power generation. The infrastructure is already in place, he writes. The crisis was primarily the result of failed preparation and planning. Otherwise, he's saying essentially this was human error, and it was preventable human error because Texas, as he says, has been to this rodeo before just 9 years ago, 10 years ago.
Yeah, that was my first month in legislative session, my first month in office when that happened. And you're right. We ask plants to winterize, but then we don't give them the opportunity to pass those costs on to consumers. And when they're competing against sometimes electricity, like what happened just a couple of days ago on Saturday, our spot prices for electricity went negative. And the cheapest electricity at the point of generation gets priority access to our grid, and that's wind and solar. And they're literally paying customers to take their product. And you're a company that's producing natural gas, fired electricity, they can't compete with that. And that's exactly what has happened. And to say that we don't have enough generation or that we have enough generation is completely false. Our population has grown significantly. Our GDP has grown significantly. And reliable generation has decreased. And that's what put us in this situation. And that's why we at the Texas Public Policy Foundation have been warning about this for years. And knew that this was coming. I quite honestly thought it would happen in August, not necessarily in a cold February, but how soon we forget.
Yeah, but is anything going to change?
I think you're going to see some of the market distorting policies that have been put in place. Those are going to get reversed. There's going to be some requirements. If you're going to put unreliable electricity on the grid, you've got to have reliable, what we refer to as dispatchable or readily available. We can't plan when you can't count on something to produce 25% of installed capacity or 1.5% of installed capacity. That's just too great of a delta. And so those unreliables are going to have to put dispatchable, readily available power back on the grid.
You've had leftist commentators take the Texas Public Policy Foundation to task for suggesting that the storm never would have been an issue had our grid not been so deeply penetrated by renewable energy sources. The criticism, a good example of this is over at NPR. That statement focused on windmills, for example, ignores the evident fact that, as Governor Abbott acknowledged on local TV, every kind of power generation fell short in the storm. And while that's true, as I mentioned at the outset, wind generation fell the shortest of them all. So there is some truth to what you and the Texas Public Policy Foundation was saying about the unreliable energy sources, as you're describing.
Yeah, and I think wind from like February 8th to February 16th, if you look at the production, I think wind dropped off 93% generation. Natural gas picked up 450%. So when ERCOT, our grid manager, began the rolling outages, they actually rolled the Permian Basin and shut off power in the largest natural gas and oil field, I believe, in the world, heavily most producing. And our natural gas supply went to less than 25% of what it was just the day before. And so that's, guess where that natural gas is going? To power plants. So if natural gas failed, it was because man made a decision, but those that were operating and online increased their production 450%. The only generation sources that we have in Texas that improved and increased production were fossil fuels. And the leftists have been demonizing them for decades, indoctrinating our kids. But last week, they saved countless lives.
Well, there was a real twist, ironic twist, and I don't mean to be flippant about it because this was life and death situation, but the federal government, what did they send in? Diesel power generators.
Yeah, it's the same thing that Microsoft sent in to one of their data centers in Silicon Valley because of all the rolling outages that California has experienced and will continue to experience. They bring in diesel generators. They get exemption from air quality permits to power their data centers. But yet they want everyone else to be 100% renewable. It's just not doable. And we found that out the hard way. And you're going to have over 40 people who lost their lives because of the cold snap last week. And it's just unfortunate, and it shouldn't have happened. And it happened during a legislative session, and I think there's going to be some serious attention paid to it. It's starting tomorrow with some of the hearings that we'll have in the House and the Senate.
So those on the left who took the opportunity of this disaster in Texas to criticize free markets as if this was a failure of markets, I think you've addressed that with the subsidies, with the government picking winners and losers. And as usual, the losers are the general public. The other criticism has been in the direction of federalism. Those in D.C. don't like federalism. They like central planning. And if Texas just wasn't such a go-it-alone state, if they had been connected to the national grid, then this wouldn't have happened.
That's not true either, and we're going to fight like crazy to keep our grid part of Texas and keep its independence. You're already seeing there's projections that there's going to be 28 gigawatts or 28,000 megawatts short of electricity in the Western Interchange in that grid. And California is going out and buying that electricity now. And that's going to impact Utah, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, all those states that are in that grid. They're going to be the ones that are suffering rolling outages because of California's leftist policies that are pushing this green bling and renewable dreams on people that aren't paying off. And so that's why we want to keep our independence and keep our grid to ourselves.
Green bling and renewable dreams. I like that.
Sounds like your next album, Dan.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah. Green bling and renewable dreams.
Yo, yo.
Maybe the name of like a Mavericks cover band or something.
Yeah.
Jason Isaac is a former Texas state legislator. He is also the director of Life Powered at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Jason, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's great to be on in Chicago. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
All right. Get ready. The Northwest Side GOP Club invites you to join them at their multi-candidate fundraiser tomorrow night, folks. Tomorrow night to support 7 GOP candidates that are advocates for change in Chicago. Yes, Chicago. The fundraiser starts at 6 p.m. at Edelweiss German American Restaurant in Norridge. Tickets are $100. They include two drinks plus an appetizer. Only one. No, you can have plenty of appetizers. There are options to direct your donations to a specific candidate or to the NWS GOP Shared Fund. So find out all the details and secure your tickets at NWSGOP.com. That's NWSGOP.com.
Did you catch the music that played you in, Amy? Did you
yeah.
catch the artist?
Who
was
that? Stevie Nicks.
That was right, Fleetwood Mac.
Fleetwood Mac.
Close enough.
Thank you.
I will take that answer.
Thank you.
It's interesting because it raises the question, which genre of music, maybe era of music as well, is the most relaxing, the best at reducing stress in your life? Well, that was the subject of a recent survey by Turkey-based cosmetic surgery center Vericlinic, which specializes in hair transplants.
Okay. I love that place.
Sure.
You go there, right? Don't you?
I go there for all my survey research, that's for sure, particularly in the area of stress. They asked 1,500 adults age 18 to 65 to undergo a series of mental stress tests during which they listened to various Spotify playlists composed of popular genres. And you know what came in number one?
What? Opera?
No. Oh. Well, no. Think era.
80s?
An era that, yes, an era that developed a genre. The 80s. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Joy Division's Love Will Tear Us Apart, Blondie's Call Me, Wham's Freedom, Wind Beneath My Wings. This was part of the Spotify 80s playlist, and this was rated number one. And I would have obviously come up with a better 80s list than that. But even still, the 80s, which is in vogue again, also stress-reducing in addition to classical music at this point. That's real classical music.
What's old is new.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.